Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point in the News this week, life and death at home and abroad, a senator collapses, U.S. troops await new strategy, and more.
Senator Tim Johnson was found to have had an intracerebral bleed caused by a congenital arteriovenous malformation.
I'm not going to be rushed into making a difficult decision.
Baghdad's morning rush was underway in downtown when two massive car bombs tore through a line of Iraqis waiting for work.
70% of the American people now disapprove of President Bush's handling of the war, an all-time high.
America's ready to turn the page. America is ready for a new set of challenges. Let's go make it happen. I appreciate it.
The Democrats' new Senate majority in the balance as South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson collapses in his office. President Bush says he needs more time to decide what to do about Iraq, where the mayhem goes on. New polls indicate Americans are more dissatisfied than ever with their leadership on Iraq. Barack Obama hits New Hampshire. It sure sounds like he's running for president. And the Golden Globe nominees are out. That was Eddie Murphy in Dreamgirls, and he can sing. This hour on Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. We have a terrific panel with us this week. In Washington, Carol Giacomo, diplomatic correspondent for Reuters, joins us. Carol, good to have you back.
Nice to be with you.
Also in Washington, Tony Blankley, editorial page editor at The Washington Times. He writes this week about the lonely president. Tony, good to have you.
Good to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Tony, and Carol.
A lot to look at this week, but I want to begin right away on the big wait for new Iraq plans. All kinds of ideas and possibilities leaking out around the edges. But, Carol, at the heart of this, what's going on? Why the wait? Why the delay?
I think that there are a couple of things. Bush has a number of questions that he still seems to be debating in his own mind. He wants to put distance between himself and or his decision and the report that just came out by the Iraq Study Group, chaired by former Secretary of State James Baker and Lee Hamilton. He has put in train some reviews of his own, a review by the Pentagon, one by the State Department, one by the National Security Council. So he wants to also get this information and put it all in the mix.
Let's hear just a little bit from White House Press Secretary Tony Snow announcing this week that the president will wait until the new year to address the nation on Iraq, would not pin down a date.
That is not going to happen until the new year. We do not know when, so I can't give you a date. I can't give you a time. I can't give you a place. I can't give you the way in which it will happen. So all those questions are yet to be answered.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice defended the president's decision to hold off.
It only makes sense for the president to take whatever time he needs to have confidence in the course that he will put forward before the American people.
On MSNBC's Hardball, former Senator John Edwards, who's expected to make another run for the presidency in 08, offered up a harsh critique.
I think the war is a mess. The Iraq Study Group report makes that very clear. It's a very sobering indictment of what's happening in Iraq right now, and the desperate need to change policy. And it's amazing to me and completely unacceptable that the President of the United States, after having led us there, helped create this mess along with the help of others, is not taking responsibility and changing course.
Tony Blankley, lots of meetings, lots of little leaks about whether it's going to be more troops or fewer, in or out, and all the rest. What do you see, what do you hear going on behind these closed doors?
Well, behind the closed doors, I don't hear anything. Let me confess, I talk to people who chat with people who are in those rooms, so it's all hearsay. Look, I think one of the more interesting events that happened was the fact that the president wants to take more time to consider his options, which I think is a wise decision, but that only a few weeks ago the White House announced that he would give his response before Christmas. So they knew then about the Baker Commission. They knew all of the facts, and they thought that they were ready to go forward within a week or two, and then they decided at the last minute they weren't. That suggests very strongly to me, and there's a little bit of anecdotal evidence to suggest that he's not been fully satisfied with the advice he's been getting from different quarters within his own administration, and he's reassessing. I don't say independent of his advisors, but he is not being fully satisfied with his advisors. I think there may be some independent thought going on in the Oval Office, not simply based on the advice of his top advisors. And I think that's why we have a delay. As to the larger issue, obviously, we've got a huge debate going between getting out quicker or putting more troops in, and what to use with more troops if they go in. Should they be trainers or they should be combat? There was an important release yesterday, American Enterprise Institute, former retired General Keane announcing a proposal that my paper, I endorsed in our editorial this morning, for 25,000 more troops for combat.
Mm. Jack Beatty, Tony Blankley, here's whispers of thought going on in the Oval Office apart from the advisors, and yet so much of what we hear is wrapped in the Pentagon suggests this to me, the Pentagon suggests that. What do you see coming when the Oval Office is thinking apart from its advisors about this?
Well, according to the McClatchy newspapers today, the president's been very influenced by the outcry on the conservative media against the Iraq Study Group, calling it surrender, and that he is more and more tempted, and that seems to be the debate now, towards sending in more troops and perhaps using those troops to confront the Sadrist militia. Now, of course, that is a militia with 60,000 members grouped heavily in Sadr City. If that were to lead to some sort of open campaign there, that would be a bloody business all around with no certain result, because this is a movement, not just a group of thugs with guns. It's a social movement. Very risky. And then, of course, there's the inordinate political irony here that we just had an election. People want out of Iraq. They don't want escalation. And this would be flying right in the face of the election and what the latest polls say, 70% disapprove of his course of the conduct of the war. So it's a very risky strategy politically. On the other hand, I've heard people say this is a favor to John McCain, that unless they do something like this, McCain will be out having a totally untenable position in 2008, wanting to go on with the war that the people are fast quitting on.
John McCain, of course, in Baghdad this week, had a Thursday press conference there where he called again for more troops in Iraq.
It requires us to have an injection of additional troops on the ground in order to bring the situation under control, in order that the political process may proceed.
Carol Giacomo, I'm seeing interpretations in a couple of directions here. The Washington Post says plans may kind of line up with some aspects of the Iraq Study Group. L.A. Times says that the president's getting advice that would from the Pentagon that would disregard key recommendations and warnings of the Iraq Study Group. So are we kicking it down the road here, kicking it out the window, paying attention, or turning our back on it at the White House?
I think you have to sort of break this down. There's the military piece of this, and there's also the diplomatic piece of it. One of the very important recommendations that Baker and Hamilton made was for the administration to begin immediately a major new diplomatic offensive that would include direct talks with Iran and Syria. The administration seems to have rejected that piece of it. Secretary Rice was quoted in an interview with the Washington Post today, basically saying as much, saying the cost of engaging Iran and Syria at this time on this issue may be too high. On the military piece, I am also hearing that the idea of putting in more troops seems to be gaining currency. But there does seem to be more interest in, using the forces to focus on training the Iraqi army so that the Iraqi army can do a better job of being able to defend the country itself. The question of going after Sadr, though, the impression I'm getting is that that's still very much in debate, that military officers may be pushing that, and there are others in the conservative neocon community who are not so keen on that.
Tony Blankley, President Bush may not want to talk with Syria and Iran, but we had U.S. senators, Democrats in the region this week, Ben Nelson of Florida talking with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. John Kerry's there now, Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, and more to come. Democrats kind of breaking out on their own initiatives here.
Well, sure. I mean, as long as they don't violate the Logan Act and actually negotiate, they're free to go and have findings and interview and talk with people. So they're going to be doing that. I think the argument against negotiating with Syria was best made, surprisingly, by the Baker Commission report in their recommendation 15, which is the recommendation to negotiate with Syria. If you look at the first about six conditions to negotiating with Syria that the Baker Commission unanimously identifies as preconditions to negotiation, they include things like Syria must stop being involved in undermining Lebanon. Well, that's not going to happen, certainly not voluntarily by them. Even the Baker Commission recognized the implausibility of that. When it comes to Iran, if we directly negotiate with Iran now, we undercut all of our nuclear negotiations we've been doing with our European allies with Iran, where they had agreed that the precondition to bilaterals between Iran and the United States was for Iran to stop the current developments. And so it's nice to talk about diplomacy, and there's no reason not to talk with anybody on the planet if it's useful. But I think when you get down to the specifics, I think the president has good basis for not buying into that part of the Baker recommendation.
Mm. We're looking at a week in the news this hour, from a senator in the hospital and a president still weighing his options on Iraq to the Saudis on a tear and more. Carol Giacomo, Reuters diplomatic correspondent in Washington, is with us. Tony Blankley, editorial page of The Washington Times. Jack Beatty's here. South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson, very much in the news this week with his collapse and we hear, stabilizing condition right now. I want to check in on that for just a moment. From South Dakota itself, we go to Sioux Falls and David Krantz. He's political columnist for the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls. David Krantz, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What's the latest you're hearing there? I'm sure everybody's watching your senator's condition very closely. What do you know?
Yeah, that would be an understatement,
yeah.
Because we've got a lot of attention out here right now, and somehow we seem to be getting more attention than our population sometimes. But it's kind of an interesting development. There are a lot of people in this state who are concerned that too much attention is being placed on replacing him if something should happen. But the reality is that something that needs to be discussed when everybody's comparing it to Carl Mundt in 1969 through 73. But the big issue here is how close the Senate numbers are right now, and that wasn't even a factor back in the Mundt days. And so right now everybody's watching close, kind of hanging in there with him, and encouraged a little bit by the news yesterday that he has an awareness of his surroundings, and I think that's significant right now.
Emergency brain surgery and stable condition, we're told. Your governor there, Governor Round, seen as a potential challenger to Tim Johnson in 08. He would be the one who would name a successor if Tim Johnson were not able to serve. Has he spoken about... It may be unseemly. All of this is a difficult conversation. Everyone's rooting for Tim Johnson to be just fine. But if he's not, what's Governor Round said?
One of the interesting parts about it, they've had a reasonably good relationship based on their efforts together with Ellsworth Air Force Base. But yesterday he did comment not on the possibility of appointments or anything like that, but commented on his well wishes for him, and many times in that conversation talked about his good friend Tim Johnson, that they're very close friends. It's almost as if he was sending a message at the same time that he was refusing to talk about what next, if what next comes. And so that was interesting. But when you go to the streets right now and talk to people out here, the most common reference by those who choose to talk about what next, if it does happen, think that Rounds would appoint himself as successor. You know, one of the reasons for that, I think, is that they're, when you look at the Republican Party right now, usually the dominant party in South Dakota, there aren't a lot of names that come to mind who would be ready to serve, and that Rounds would probably get some support, particularly at the national level, because national Republicans have told me that absolutely in 2008 they want Rounds to be their candidate against Johnson. That's before all this happened.
Wow, and he wants to go to the Senate, or is said to, and that would be one way to do it. Would South Dakotans find that acceptable, do you think, or unseemly?
Well, I think everybody looks to the east over here and looks back to 1976 with Walter Mondale in Minnesota when he became vice president. Wendell Anderson appointed himself, That didn't go over very well. The voters defeated him the next time around. First time he had a chance to run for election in his own right, and a lot of people look at that and say that potential resentment is there because Johnson's well-respected, as is Rounds, but it might be one of those things where the governor might be overplaying his hand if he did do that. So I think he's got to be awfully cautious about that move.
So tricky business, and prayers for Senator Tim Johnson. David Krantz in Sioux Falls, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
David Krantz, political columnist at the Argus Leader. Tony Blankley, what do you make of the nation's capital's conversation this week? It looks like a kind of fixed focus here on Tim Johnson and this very narrow Democratic majority. What's the word in the Capitol today?
Well, I mean, the tone of it all is somewhat ghoulish. And mm-hmm. It started the other night, I guess it was Wednesday night, when the word came out. I was at the White House Christmas party, and reporters and political people who were there were all muttering about it in a purely political context rather than in the human context. I would just put one bit of admonition out that I think there's a long history of injured or sick politicians putting out information that is not always accurate. I think there's a high need for news organizations to have doctors on call to analyze all of the reports before we jump to false positive or false negative conclusions about the medical bulletins. I mean, everyone from Reagan to President Cleveland, they all tend to put out information that Wallace, when
it
he was
suits
shot.
Them.
And so I think we have to be very careful about jumping to any conclusions about the senator's conditions.
Jack Beatty, the South Dakota Secretary of State, Chris Nelson, said only two things he's aware of would create a vacancy, death or resignation. There's a lot of history here. We don't know exactly where Tim Johnson will end up. Everyone wishes him the best, but the fragility of that Democratic majority very much on display this week.
Very much on display, and of course, one always thinks of Joe Lieberman, the independent, who really is the make-weight here. Even with their majority, he is an unstable factor. You're right. Senators have served in varying degrees of incapacity for a long, long time. Nina Totenberg was just going through her own file on this, and she was talking about people. Strom Thurmond, for the last several years of his tenure in the Senate, was really being led around by somebody and helped and so on, and he didn't, I guess he knew what day it was, but he didn't know much more than that. So senators do hang on, and it seems that only death usually parts them from their office.
Let's take a call from David in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
We're well. What do you know?
The biggest story of the news has got to be Bush's cold shoulder to the Baker Group report. You remember the Mark Twain story or joke about how stupid he thought his father was when he was 16, and by the time he turned 21, he was amazed how much his father had learned.
The president's a lot older than 21, but he's right. not jumping on his father's footsteps here.
The amazing thing is that all the people who've made George Jr.'s career get together to save his butt, throw him a life preserver, and he rejects it. I mean, the amazing thing is, you know, it's not a particular policy change or a particular schedule or, you know, a quick announcement as opposed to a slow announcement that we're looking for. The country is looking for a sign that this guy has learned anything from the last 6 years of disaster.
David, we hear that view. Let us listen to President Bush himself for a moment, if we may, from this week. Carol, Tony, Jack, here on Wednesday, President Bush met with senior defense officials, came out, held a press conference, didn't say when he would address the nation, but offered a glimpse of what he might say.
At the appropriate time, I will stand up in front of the nation and say, here's where we're headed. But one thing people got to understand is we'll be headed toward achieving our objectives. And I repeat, if we lose our nerve, if we're not steadfast in our determination to help the Iraqi government succeed, we will be handing Iraq over to an enemy that would do us harm.
There's the president on Wednesday, and he had more to say as well. Talked about the consequences of leaving Iraq before the job is done, said they would be grave for the American people.
As we learned on September the 11th, the enemy has got the capacity to strike us. And there's no doubt in my mind a failure in Iraq would make it more likely the enemy would strike us. It would certainly make it more likely that moderate people around the Middle East would wonder about the United States' will. Moderate people, moderate governments in the Middle East would be making irrational decisions about their future. It would be a disaster for governments that have got energy resources to be in the hands of these extremists. They would use energy to extract blackmail from the United States. And when you couple all that with a regime that is doesn't like the United States having a nuclear weapon, you can imagine a world of turmoil, and we're not going to let it happen.
President Bush, this week, as he decides not to point exactly where he's headed, for now, let's go to caller Paul in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Hi, dear guest. Well, just go there. I would like to say that to discuss this issue with, you know, the Baker-Hamilton report and the stay the course issue, we need to make a very, very important distinction between the mission and the strategy on the ground to accomplish the mission. And I think Bush is very clear all along, or tries to be, that when he's talking about stay the course, he's talking about the mission. And I think a lot of the opponents of Bush, for political reasons, particularly with the sound bites I've been hearing this morning, try to basically paint with a broad brush that he's talking about the strategy to make him seem like a crazy person, like, oh, I have the strategy on the ground and I'm sticking with it and people are dying and I don't care.
So what do you see, Paul?
I see that he's very open to looking at the strategy, but he's very determined on the mission, and I agree with that, and I think the overall mission is important, but you have to adapt the strategy to achieve the mission, and to paint him as a person who doesn't want to look at the strategy, I think is irresponsible.
What's the mission now, in your view? How do you interpret it?
I'm sorry?
What is the mission now? How do you interpret it? I mean, we're there. We don't want to fail, but what's the mission?
The mission, as he says clearly, is to ultimately create a stable Iraq that has, you know, a government in place that can defend itself and, you know, become a thriving nation without the security and the civil war issues, and ultimately some form, you know, not perfect, but some form of self-sustaining democracy, and, you know, that gives the population a chance to participate in their country.
So don't judge too quickly, you say, Paul, and we hear that. Carol Giacomo, the president says, if we lose our nerve, we're in trouble here. A failure in Iraq, he says, would make it more likely the enemy would strike us. Paul says, essentially, let's stick with him on this. Others are saying, we've failed already.
Look, this is Bush's legacy, and this is going to be the issue on which he's going to be judged most acutely when he leaves office in 2 years. So, and I agree that I think he is absolutely committed to the mission. Secretary Rice yesterday reinforced this idea that democracy as the compelling sort of passionate force behind their worldview remains in place. I am not convinced yet, though, that he is ready to make the kinds of tactical changes on the ground that may be needed now to try to see if he can actually salvage his goal of a stable democracy in Iraq. And that's what we're waiting to see. Rice yesterday also, you know, indicated that there would be some departure from the current strategy, but she made very clear that it would not be radical. So the components of that are exactly what we're waiting for.
Tony Blankley, what's the realist view, however you want to define that, of what can be salvaged of the Iraq goal, mission at this point?
Well, I'm not probably the best person to represent American foreign policy establishment realism, which I consider to be a sort of an unrealistic view.
Realism by your own definition, if you will.
But yeah, look, by the way, I concur completely with the caller whose shrewd assessment of distinguishing between mission and strategy and tactics. For those of us like me who have supported the president's mission and continue to, I have been, and many of us have been, frustrated that he has been unwilling to even reconsider strategies and tactics. That's something what I think has changed in the last few months. Now I think he is open, everything I've heard, he is open now to fairly dramatically shifting strategies and tactics towards the same mission. Look, the mission of democracy, which or even pluralistic or somewhat more representative government from Afghanistan to Lebanon is still very much in play. Afghanistan may go either way. Lebanon may go either way. If Iraq can be stabilized into something benign, that will put more pressure on Syria and on Iran. Iran has a lot of domestic problems. Ahmadinejad was booed at a rally recently. So there's a lot of potential there. Now, it could all go south on us, of course, but I think the president's right not to give up on that, and the potential for success over many years or decades is enough to justify continued persistence.
Jack Beatty, stay the course on looking for something benign in Iraq. What do you say?
Well, it seems to me that's very hard to find. I mean, the president, yes, he's been fixated on his the mission. What he hasn't been acknowledging is reality, and this is the issue here. How much of this reality is he taking aboard? Is he really understanding the depth of what's happening now? These killings every day, this implosion of society as terrorist act begets retaliation, on and on. And does he understand how little that is subject to correction by military means? As General Hayden said in briefing the Senate, the battlefield is getting smaller and smaller with fewer and fewer groups of people fighting over smaller and smaller spaces. That's not a battlefield that can be altered by 20,000 troops. It seems to me that is a folly. And once they're in there, they will stay there. And once they're in there, they will be targets. And once they're there, they will go on. They will be killed and maimed. You know, the one thing he has control over here, and the one thing we can be certain of, is those soldiers can be alive if they're removed. That's the one fact in all of this. Nothing else is certain. That's certain. People whose lives will be destroyed, even if they are alive, can be saved from a mission that has failed and looks to have further failure written all over.
When they're gone, they're gone. Republican Senator from Oregon, Gordon Smith, a strong supporter of the decision to go to war, broke ranks this week, made the remarks on Thursday. Listen to this pretty tough attack.
And I, for one, am at the end of my rope when it comes to supporting a policy that has our soldiers patrolling the same streets in the same way, being blown up by the same bombs day after day. That is absurd. It may even be criminal. I cannot support that anymore.
That was Republican Senator from Oregon, Gordon Smith, last Thursday. He came back early this week on Sunday, said, look, I voted to get Saddam out. I voted to go after weapons of mass destruction, not to be sitting in the middle of sectarian strife. We're looking at a week in the news with Carol Giacomo of Reuters, Tony Blankley of The Washington Times, Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Melissa. Hi, Melissa, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm intrigued with how Barack Obama did in New Hampshire, because I feel like people are analyzing that politically, and I think it needs a different approach. I think he represents hope, whether it's Republican or Democrat, and that we haven't had that in politics a long time, especially with what happened with Tom DeLay. And people are talking about maybe he's running too early and he'll peter out the way John Edwards did or Howard Dean, but the aftershocks of what he's doing can be picked up by another candidate, just like Patrick Duvall picked up some of what Howard Dean's tactics in Massachusetts.
Melissa, are you assuming at this point that Barack Obama is running for president? Of course, he hasn't announced yet.
What do you think? Anybody who goes to New Hampshire this early is running.
Okay. Let us look at that, Melissa. Thanks for your call. Let's listen to just a little bit of that. And Jack Beatty, I know you're around this turf. Here's Barack Obama making his first visit of the to New Hampshire last Sunday. The Illinois senator told the standing room only crowds there why he thinks he's getting so much attention.
I have to confess that there's been a little bit of fuss about me lately. But I actually think that the reason that I'm getting so much attention right now has less to do with me and more to do with you. I think to some degree I've become a symbol for now of a spirit that the last election in New Hampshire represented. It's a spirit that says we are looking for something different. We want something new.
Jack Beatty, were you there? Did you hear that?
I was there. According to one old political hand up here, he'd seen nothing like it in 40 years. This was a sellout 1,500-person crowd of Democrats, ostensibly there to see the celebration of the state Democrats' big victory this year. They won pretty much everything. The governor joked that they had invited the Rolling Stones, but then they realized that Obama would sell more tickets, and indeed he did. And this was in Manchester. Earlier in the day, he had had 900 people for a book signing in Portsmouth. Again, unprecedented at this point in his career. And he was very impressive in his way. What struck me about him, I had never seen him speak before other than at the convention, was the ease he showed with himself. You can't fake that. That's either there or it's not. And I don't think we had it from Bill Clinton. He was desperate to please other people. You could see it in everything he said. He was incomplete that way, and I don't think we see it in the conflicted, strutting George Bush. But here was a fellow who seemed to be pretty much at ease with who he was. And that communicated, I thought, a great deal of strength. And people were going out remarking on that, remarking on his voice, on his articulateness without any rhetoric, and on his stress again and again of bipartisanship and across-the-aisle solutions and getting beyond polarization and working problems out. That, I think, went over very well with the audience. And earlier in the day, someone looked in a coffee shop in Manchester, and who was there having coffee with two people?
Yeah.
Evan Bayh of Indiana, who's also running for president.
Another hopeful, but without the same crowd.
Without the pizzazz.
Carol Giacomo, you're a diplomatic correspondent there. We've been talking about Iraq. Now here's Obama. You know, he's got charisma. He's fresh in foreign policy circles. Does it look like he has answers?
Well, the thing is, of course, that he has very little experience. People draw the comparison very often with the Bush team, which came into office with incredible experience. Cheney, Rice, they had all had, Rumsfeld, they had all had big positions in previous administrations, and yet, you know, people will say they produce the situation in Iraq, which is not going so well. And critics will also say that they have not done so well on Iran or on North Korea. And they turned to Obama and they said, well, he may be inexperienced, but the question is the judgment. Does he have good judgment? And people who are inclined to support Obama say he has good judgment. And just sort of parenthetically, he is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and has been working on a number of different issues with Richard Lugar, who's the Republican chairman. And in fact, Lugar seems to have, be almost tutoring Obama in some aspects of foreign policy.
Tony Blankley, here's John McCain, presidential White House aspirant in Baghdad, calling for more troops at a time when Americans, the polls are showing this week, very, very fed up with the war. Obama at home, without the same war experience as McCain, who looks better positioned as we start to line up for 08 here?
Well, it's too soon to say how Obama is positioned because we don't know his positions. He is, anytime somebody comes along who's got an admirable personality and a winning personality and speaks to hope and a new start in America, which something like Reagan in the 70s, has a strong opportunity because that is so much more appealing than the run-of-the-mill, down-of-the-mouth, complaining hack politicians, which a lot of people project as an image. Having said that, he comes with an unformed set of policies. I'm going to be interested to see what he actually does on Iraq. He was pretty anti-war when he was running in 2004. Will he be adamant? He's soon going to have a chance to vote for or against appropriations for more troops, my guess, or at least sustaining troops. Will he vote against the appropriations, as a lot of the liberal internet sites and other activists want, or will he vote like Hillary and say, be responsible, with quotes around it? I don't know how he's going to position himself on the issues yet. I certainly agree with you that McCain seems ill-positioned supporting more troops troops. On the other hand, McCain is, I think, although I disagree with him a lot of stuff, a principled politician, and particularly on this. And I think the public also likes men and women who stand by their convictions.
Let's go to Jack, yes.
Yeah, in today's Chicago Tribune, there's an interview with Obama, the editorial board, and they ask him about a matchup with McCain, and he said, yeah, that would be something, quote, war hero against snot-nosed rookie. Well, that's Obama.
That's what you call self-deprecating humor.
Yes, indeed.
Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. I've got a couple of comments. You know what America hates is this on-the-fence situation. Mm-hmm. I call it on-the-fence because it's like Vietnam. One radical thinking that we could have done, it's very radical thinking, is that when we took over Iraq, we could have taken over the country. And that way we could have drawn a line in the sand. As Bush said, you're either for us or against us. If we'd have taken over the country, we'd have found out who was for us or against us.
But what does that mean, to take over the country? We've got an awful lot of troops there, did we not?
It means actually taking over, making it part of America. It means, hey, you know, you Iraq people, ask the Americans how well they like their country. But I've got a couple of more comments that are more important. Let me move on. If we withdraw now, Bush knows and anybody knows that it will become a state, a terrorist state, probably of Iran, and we will probably, reap it over here. Anyway, what I would like to see, if we're going to stay there, and I think everyone who has any sense would agree with me, is take our boys out of harm's way. Let them be purely trainers of the Iraq people. Only the Iraq can pull their bootstraps. It's their country now. It's not ours. It's theirs. Therefore, we can still hold our heads high and say, look, we were there to train you, to support you against the terrorists, against the bad guys, but only as trainers. Only take our guys out of harm's way.
There's a lot of talk about that right now. Yes, yes, Tom.
The other last thought is this. I think there's a lot of integrity lacking in Washington, and for this reason. Love makes the world go round, but you know what? The big corporations in America make the wheels of America go round. What we've done is we put world police throughout the world so these corporations can get cheap labor. We've backed these regimes for the purpose of these companies. That's what makes America go round. It's these big corporations, and it's wrong, and we're going to reap the whirlwind. I wish we would bring in all of this police of the world and get back to statesmen of real integrity. Money is what's driving this America, and we need to have integrity driving it.
Tom, we hear your wheels turning in a lot of directions there. We appreciate your call. Tony Blankley, let's go to this issue. Tom says, make it the 51st state or pull back to the edges, you know, get out or at least to the borders. One interesting thing there, the Saudis this week saying, if you pull back and let our Sunni brethren in Iraq get into trouble, we may swing in on their side. We're told that King Abdullah said to Dick Cheney. What do you make of that, Tony?
Well, I mean, there's nothing surprising about that. I and many other people have been predicting that Saudi Arabia is likely to come in on the side of the Sunnis, as Iran will come in on the side of the Shias if we remove ourselves and turn it into the maelstrom. I mean, interestingly, there was an op-ed by Nawaf Obaid, I think his name was, who was an advisor to the Saudi embassy, just that.
Mm-hmm.
He was then fired. And now the New York Times is reporting, was it yesterday, that what he said is fundamentally true, and that the Saudis are, at least with private money and private public in Saudi Arabia, sort of an ambiguous line between them sometimes, supporting the Sunni or threatening to support the Sunnis. So that's a real threat. As far as the caller's suggestion about going into enclaves and just doing training, that is what a lot of the Pentagon wants to do. I judge that to be not useful, that as you go into enclaves and you reduce the number of forts that are more and more remote, what are you doing there? You're just hiding and trying to protect your forces from terrorist attack. That's simply a step to getting out, which if you want to do, you might as well do straight. I think the Iraqi military is so far from being ready to take the fight to the sectarians and terrorists and gangsters that it's an illusion for us to rely on that. We should be training them, but we should not expect that the training will come to fruition anytime soon.
Carol Giacomo, what do you make of the Saudi dance this week? Their ambassador, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, resigning. Of course, he was their intelligence chief for many years. Dick Cheney, you know, being warned here by the king himself. What's going on with Saudi Arabia?
Well, Saudi Arabia is a Sunni-majority country, and its other Sunni allies in the region are very, very worried about Iran. Iran is positioning Iran, which is a Shiite majority country, has very strong connection to the Shiite government in Iraq and is a rising power in the region and is positioning itself as a rising power, which is developing a nuclear weapons program. So the Saudis are extremely worried about this, and they were basically warning the Americans, as they had warned the Americans before the United States went into Iraq, you know, if you're going to go in, we're anxious about it, but you better do it right, and you better do the whole job. And now they're seeing a security situation which is deteriorating, and talk in Washington about withdrawal, and they're very concerned, and they just want to make sure that the Americans hear what they're saying and take their worries into consideration. I mean, there was a corollary move by Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, I think it was last week, where they commissioned a study basically to look at development of nuclear energy. And this also is a sign to America and also to Iran that if the Iranians are going to continue to pursue their nuclear program, then the Sunni majority states are also going to be looking at that as well.
Jack Beatty, can't you imagine the Bush administration wishing they could have the Saudis then, if they want Americans there, pay for it, as they did in the Gulf War? But, of course, they can't, because this time the Shia are large and in charge in Baghdad.
Yes. You know, there's some more light on the story today from Steve Clemens of the strategy. He directs the strategy program for the New American Foundation. He's got a note saying that sources tell him, he mentions four current Saudi foreign ministry officials, that Ambassador Turkey's decision to resign really had more to do with the signals that Prince Bandar, former ambassador and now security advisor to the Saudi government, was sending to Cheney and David Addington and others on Cheney's staff, that Saudi Arabia would look with favor, would acquiesce to, accept, quote, and not interfere with U.S. military action against Iran. Ooh. And that was what the ambassador resigned over.
Well, there's the fundamental tension in the region. I want to get one more call here. Mike's calling. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Quickly, I'm just concerned about the war in Afghanistan. It seems like it's the forgotten war, which is heating up again. And I have a son going over there, so I'm still concerned that they're undermanned over there. And
when's he going, Mike?
2 days after Christmas.
2 days after Christmas to Afghanistan with what service?
He's with the Army. He's going into Afghanistan.
And what's he saying to you? Is he feeling good, confident about it? What's he hearing as he prepares to go?
Well, he's ready. He's ready. There's no problem with him. It's the parents. You know, we see what's going on, and I'd like to see, you know, more support over there. I know Iraq's sucking all the money and media time, but Afghanistan is where we started, and it doesn't seem as if we finished with that.
And you've got a son headed right there 2 days after Christmas, Mike. We wish him absolutely the best, good luck there. But Carol Giacomo, what about Afghanistan? Awful lot of warnings here. Talk that Al-Qaeda is essentially taking over a chunk of northwest Pakistan next door. Sign of light in Afghanistan?
There's a, you know, growing concern about the situation in Afghanistan, which, of course, was the first front after 9/11, and then the United States moved on to Iraq. But now Afghanistan seems to be really becoming a more serious problem. The poppy cultivation has, you know, exponentially grown, so that there's that sort of economic base of the country which is causing huge problems. The border, the Pakistanis had reached an agreement with tribal leaders in the border region a couple of months ago, which the basis of it was essentially that the tribal leaders were going to try to rein in the activities on the border by Al-Qaeda and Taliban supporters. This apparently hasn't happened, and there's growing concern that this area is becoming a haven for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban to basically regroup. It's a serious problem.
Not a pretty picture to be sending one's son into, Jack Beatty. That's happening in Iraq as well, maybe staying longer. You hear Mike's concern there as his own son heads to Afghanistan. It matters to get the right policy here, Jack.
Oh, so much matters. And, you know, sometimes for a president, greatness lies just in figuring out those to whom he has primary responsibility. And those are people like Mike's son and the others whose good wishes I know we all share.
Mm. Jack, thanks for being with us today. And Tony Blankley, thank you.
Thank you.
Carol Giacomo with Reuters, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.